Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
God, just the rain is so loud.
It's so insane.
I don't know what to do about this. It's
like, nothing. It's going to be a dramatic recording.
Tell the roof to stop making noise.
Excuse me. Trying to podcast here.
Welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias here with Dara Lind. There's been a lot of transition personnel announcements, and one of them is in the Department of Homeland Security vein, where I've not seen a lot of discussion, but which I think is pretty important given both the nature of sort of Trump era policymaking here, but also the reality that this is a space where administrative decision making is very, very important. The executive branch is an important thing always, but we know that there's a couple of areas, international diplomacy being a big one and immigration enforcement being another one, where actually how you run the executive branch makes a huge difference in people's lives. On the economy, The president matters, but Janet Yellen can't conjure up a stimulus bill all on her own. But Barack Obama did conjure up a bunch of stuff in different directions over the course of his 8 years. Trump conjured up a bunch of stuff. And now it is going to be in the hands, it seems, of Alejandro Mayorkas to figure out what to do next. So who is this guy?
Ali Mayorkas, former Obama administration appointee who has now kind of been leveled up. And, you know, Matt, you probably know this more generally than I do, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like many of the Biden appointees so far are either kind of longtime Biden confidants or the folks who were kind of next in line at the end of the Obama administration, which makes sense, right? Like those are the people who have the most relevant executive experience in Democratic policymaking circles. So Mayorkas was literally Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security at the end of the Obama administration. Prior to that, he'd been the director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which is the agency that handles legal immigration to the U.S. Before that, he had a kind of traditional prosecutorial. He was U.S. Attorney for the Central District of California for a while. You know, it's not an unusual background in any regard, but the fact that he's coming out of an Obama administration that wasn't particularly beloved by immigration activists, but within which he was seen as an immigration dove, is kind of, those are two relevant data points for not just how his appointment has been regarded, but also what the Biden administration is attempting to deal with on, you know, immigration in particular. But I think there are other analogous areas where I think criminal justice certainly comes to mind, where there's more attention to them among the Democratic base now than there was under the Obama administration. And the Obama administration's record wasn't so, you know, consistently progressive that status quo anti-Trumpum is a satisfactory response in the eyes of the Democratic base.
And I think it's worth actually starting just with the fact that Mayorkas is an immigration guy, right? He was deputy secretary. Before that, he ran USCIS, just because the Department of Homeland Security is a new agency in the scheme of things. And its genesis was in sort of post 9/11 politics, in the sense that it was a true something must be done kind of situation,
yep,
right? In which it was like 9/11 happened. It was very bad. All these people were dead. People didn't want that to happen again. They wanted the government to do some things. There was a war happening in Afghanistan, and there was a belief that there should be some changes to the domestic orchestration of the United States. And I think if you go back to that time, there was a lot of talk about the idea that there should be a counterterrorism agency of some kind in the United States of America. That right now, counterterrorism is a unit of the FBI, which does a bunch of different things. And a point that a lot of people would make is that a criminal investigative agency, which is what the FBI primarily is, waits for crimes to happen, and then it tries to figure out who did them, right? So, like, white-collar crime happens at the FBI, and, like, they get reports, right? A whistleblower could go to the FBI. There could be victims of a scam, and they say, somebody's got to help us, right? And then the FBI tries to investigate it. If somebody robs a bank, the FBI will investigate that. If somebody kidnaps someone, the FBI will investigate that. You don't want to catch terrorists after they blow up buildings, right? That's not the goal. You don't think of deterrence as operating in that kind of way, right? So maybe we should have like a domestic counterterrorism agency. But like, we didn't do that, right? Ultimately, the FBI really likes having the counterterrorism brief. The congressional committees don't want to do this. So they created this thing that if you look at movies from the late aughts, the Department of Homeland Security is often portrayed as a domestic counterterrorism agency, right? Like it seems like there maybe should be one, and maybe that's what should be the Department of Homeland Security. But what they actually did was they put FEMA and some other sort of disaster response agencies together with immigration and border security agencies.
And some parts of the kind of general protecting the infrastructure of government stuff, including the the main cybersecurity agency, CISA, which has been in the news for election security reasons recently. Like, there was an extent to which that was contemplated as part of the brief, but it too ran into the same kind of power politics that a lot of other things did, which is why, the reason that I found myself thinking about this earlier this year was that when the Department of Homeland Security sent federal agents to help protect the federal courthouse in Portland, you know, that's theoretically something that they could do because it was federal property, but that interacted with the U.S. Marshals Service and the Office of the Courts inside DOJ in fairly arcane ways that counterterrorism kind of got carved out within existing power politics and fiefdoms, and DHS got what no one was powerful enough to fight for.
Right. And I think the basic thing to know about this is that, you know, the Treasury Department is kind of like a unitary thing. Like, they all work in the same building. They all really do sort of report to the secretary. A lot of cabinet agencies just kind of like have things that are under them on the org chart. And DHS is really like that. Like, post 9/11, the powers that be did not really want to restructure many of the agencies that do things. What they instead did was rearrange, like, which agencies point up to where. And so DHS is a holding pen for a bunch of agencies. But the first two secretaries, Bush's secretaries, Tom Ridge and Michael Chertoff, you were supposed to understand as, like, counterterrorism guys. Like, that was Bush. He was a war president. The fact that they were actually running immigration policy was, like, a little bit incidental in some ways to the atmospherics of it, even though it was significant. But then Obama makes Janet Napolitano DHS secretary under the theory that we're bringing in a border state governor who is going to execute the Obama pincers movement, where they were going to secure the border to, like, show everybody that illegal immigration has been fixed. And then there was going to be a path to citizenship. And, like, everything on immigration policy has, like, rolled downhill from that not working at all.
My historical narrative of this is slightly different. I do think that the salience of immigration as part of the DHS brief came under Bush when Chertoff was simultaneously trying to back Bush's efforts at comprehensive immigration reform and trying to himself step up immigration enforcement as kind of the alternative to that. So that by the time the Obama administration arrived in office, there were lots of policies on the ground that had been put into place in the last few years to ramp up immigration enforcement that now needed overseeing, and the political salience of immigration as like a thing that DHS handled was higher than it had been in 2004. But there were concerns toward the end of the Obama administration about like how the Secret Service was being run in particular. That was in part a matter of, it seemed that it had been neglected and that like so most of the kind of concerns about how DHS was being run were concerns of, that were essentially battles over immigration policy. And, you know, with the enforcement unions, initially the union representing ICE agents, and then toward the end of the Obama administration, also the union representing Border Patrol agents, becoming very outspoken against the Obama administration's political appointees, against its agenda, saying that their needs as stakeholders in the federal government were being disregarded, that their morale was in the pits because they weren't being allowed to do their jobs. You know, that was kind of an ongoing theme that tended to reflect poorly on the people running DHS. It wasn't until 2014 when Obama's second DHS secretary, Jay Johnson, spent a lot of time doing kind of stakeholder management in developing a new slate of immigration policies that you saw not only the Obama administration finally get on the same page between what the president was saying was happening on immigration enforcement and like what was actually happening in ICE field offices. But also, that's the first point when what DHS is doing became the central story of the Obama administration's DHS, rather than DHS is trying to get things done and it's not really working and it's clear that something is broken here and we haven't totally figured out what. And then, of course, with the Trump administration, we've had a series of DHS secretaries, none of whom have been formally confirmed since, you know, Christian Nielsen, who was confirmed at the end of 2017. The idea that the DHS secretary is supposed to be the top immigration cop has really overtaken the rest of the department, which was a problem both for kind of Nielsen herself, who was primarily a cybersecurity person, and for any part of DHS that isn't directly involved in immigration enforcement.
Right. And so the point of this whole long windup is that as far as I know from reporting on the Biden transition, the understanding has always been that when they are selecting a DHS head, they are looking for somebody who can mediate between the White House, immigration advocacy groups, objective political circumstances on Capitol Hill, and the immigration enforcement career people. That there was no serious thought to like, well, we need somebody who's going to like really fix our hurricane response.
Given what DHS is, you are never going to find someone who has requisite experience in all of the different substantive issue areas. The best you're going to do is somebody with experience in one of the substantive issue areas and management experience within DHS headquarters, which is exactly what Mayorkas has.
Right. And I think a big part, I mean, if you want to understand the appeal of Mayorkas to the Biden team, it's exactly that, that he is aware of the many, many, many pitfalls that befell the Obama administration at various different points in time here. They had a lot of issues with, they would say things and the things that they said did not reflect actual policy. They would try to get people to change what they were doing, but the exact lines of command are not super duper clear. For example, Department of Homeland Security leads immigration enforcement, but U.S. attorneys are part of the Justice Department. So it's both the case that you have all these immigration cases being prosecuted and also that the immigration officials are not quite in charge of that. And then you have the fact that
a lot of immigration law is essentially set by Department of Justice political appointees at the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is among the many kind of tools for making immigration policy that was somewhat dormant prior to the Trump administration and then used super aggressively. So that's some of the concern looking forward as well, as you need someone who understands how other departments are going to have to end up being agitated to make immigration in particular more of a focus than you would necessarily think in like going in to run DOJ or labor.
And then last, but really, really not least, right? You have the difficult issue of prioritization, which this is something that the Obama team kept tripping over. And if you think about it in like analogy terms, right? No police department in America, as far as I know, puts a lot of emphasis on solving car break-in cases, right? Like, it's just not done. Like, no police officers think they should put a lot of emphasis on that. No police chiefs think they should. No mayors think they should. Voters don't think they should. Like, everybody agrees that, like, it's on the one hand not great that people break into cars parked on the street sometimes, but also not what the focus should be. If some cop somewhere, though, like, spends all day chasing somebody down and they arrest them, like, well, you're arrested. Like, it's a crime, right? And if it happened to be the case that all the rank and file officers in some department somewhere, like, this is what they wanted to do with their time, it would be challenging to get them to not do it because the laws say what they say. And if you're arrested, you're arrested. And the Obama administration said that they did not think that finding people who were inside the United States somewhere had been for a while and were not breaking new laws. They said that should not be the priority of immigration enforcement, which has a certain common sense ring to it as well as particular policy things. But the ICE agents, like, they don't agree with that view.
Right. And there are also certain operational difficulties, right? Like, in the absence of telling people here is what you should be spending your efforts going after and having robust external safeguards, as long as you have a policy of if you run into someone who you think is arrestable in the context of an enforcement operation, you can get them, then you're going to end up with some people who, you know, theoretically should be deprioritized. And that kind of operational tension is a big deal. You know, it's a problem that hasn't been entirely fixed yet, because the only way you can actually implement your policies is to literally tell agents, you cannot bring this person into the system unless they are a priority as we have previously defined them. But that is a higher degree of control over the operations of the front line than you typically see in a law enforcement context. And it was one that they just didn't find, that the people who on the front lines don't find an acceptable, you know, an acceptable way to be told to do their jobs.
Right. And you know, that gets back to the thing, right? That it would be to create a formal policy that, like, we will never arrest a car breaker inner would be a different thing. It's easy. If the immigration enforcement personnel just overwhelmingly agreed in their bones that, like, they shouldn't be doing lots of interior enforcement, and also politicians generally agreed with that, it would be easy enough to have a sort of wink-wink policy about it. But, like, the fact is that this is subject to intense ongoing political contestation. Lots and lots of elected officials all around the country believe that interior enforcement should be a big priority. The immigration enforcement officers themselves believe it should be a priority. There's plenty of gray zone kind of stuff. And then the activists really wanted what ultimately arrived in DAPA, which was some kind of much more formal thing saying, like, no, like, you can sign up, you're going to get a thing, it's going to immunize you from prosecution. And, you know,
right. Yeah, it's worth slowing down a little bit to disambiguate here, because there are, like, basically there were two strategies that the Obama administration pursued that ended up working. The first one, which was the first successful one, and then but, like, its application was limited, was DACA in 2012, which they then tried to expand in 2014 and add, you know, for a different population with DAPA, both of which got held up in court and are essentially DOA. Like, nobody is talking about, we're going to bring back DAPA, because it's assumed that the Supreme Court would.
Yes, the Supreme Court has not gotten friendlier.
But at the same time, it is generally assumed that the Biden administration will quickly resuscitate the original DACA program, which Trump's attempt to undo it was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2020. And, you know, they've then kind of put it on ice in a way that is itself being challenged in court. So it'll be easy to resuscitate. But that model is the kind of affirmative, you're going to sign up, you're going to get a thing model. The other thing that they did that was ultimately successful, but this is where it took, like, you know, Jay Johnson doing a lot of internal legitimacy work, essentially, was at the end of 2014, when they announced expanding DACA and DAPA, they also announced a new set of interior enforcement priorities, which did remain in place through the end of the administration. There weren't successful court challenges to them. And those were clearer than their predecessors had been. They created more space for, you know, there were some cases, frankly, in which people who had not been considered priorities prior to those memos were now kind of, you could squeeze them into like priority two. So there was a little bit of space for expanded enforcement. And it allowed for exceptions for like recent border crossers and for so-called immigration absconders and other cases other than just having a criminal record, which would satisfy a certain constituency of immigration hawks. Those were stopped in the first week of the Trump administration. They replaced them with a set of guidelines that essentially said, that named a bunch of categories that covered a lot of the unauthorized population and then said, and if you run into anybody else in the course of your duties, go ahead and arrest them. Nobody is putting forward publicly a way to do that that is going to be successful rather than look more like their attempts in 2010 and 2011 and 2013 to restrict the scope of what ICE agents can do on the ground. So when we think about interior enforcement in particular, those are kind of the two tracks on which you can expect to see executive branch policy in the first year of the Biden administration. Is like, what efforts are there to affirmatively protect people along the lines of DACA? What are the, like, are they going to continue to use deferred action, or are there other legal mechanisms there? There's something called parole in place that there's some activist energy around. There are some other things you can do as well. And then on the second prong, what is being done to restrict what ICE agents can do on the ground, and how are ICE agents responding to that?
So, I mean, I think, you know, big picture, this sounds like a nightmare job.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a reason that, like, Matt, when you wrote your pre-election, like, who can we expect in Biden's cabinet? Ali Mayorkas was the only name listed for Homeland Security. When I was asking people, you know, before the election, who's going to be DHS? Like, Mayorkas was the only name that seriously came up because of the population of people who, like, have, as we said before, the requisite substantive and managerial experience, and who actually want the job.
Right. This is the key thing, is that most cabinet picks, I mean, we can talk about how many people were really seriously considered for different things, but every cabinet job, except for DHS, there was a number of politicians who were at least legitimately trying to get the job. There are a lot of frustrated backbench House members and random people. Pete Buttigieg, Rahm Emanuel, both seem desperate to get cabinet jobs of vague portfolio. Nobody like that wanted to be DHS secretary, right? Which is why it wound up being that Mayorkas was the only name on the list. That you know, it was going to be some kind of a bureaucrat, so to speak. He was deputy secretary. He's Hispanic. He has the immigration background from inside the agency, and he wanted to do it. So it's like there's almost no need to have any other conversations in that regard. There's a huge question in my mind, though, as to whether he or anybody is confirmable in this position, because when you talk about, like, well, is anyone going to be confirmable for any job at all? The answer often goes back to Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, and Lisa Murkowski, who are seen as the reasonable Republicans who would like to have a functional government and, you know, would various reasons that you're familiar with. None of those are people who have any noteworthy record of being dovish on immigration in any real way. Like Collins likes to get in on bipartisan deals. Obviously, Maine is like the least immigrant-heavy state in the known universe. Mitt Romney, back when he was trying to prove he wasn't a moderate squish from Massachusetts, like being tough on immigration was like the thing that he's like, yes, has a solidly right-wing record on. Again, Alaska, like, you know, so it's not the kind of thing where I would anticipate that even the moderate Republican members would like to come in and be dovish on. Republicans like the rank and file people at the Border Patrol and ICE, right? So like, if nobody's minding the store, they're probably satisfied with that outcome. The policy changes that activists want Biden to make are uniformly things that Republicans think are bad ideas. Joe Manchin and John Tester are also probably not incredibly excited about the Democratic Party picking a lot of fights with, you know, the Border Patrol union and things like that. So it seems really an open question to me as to like what the plan for moving forward with this could possibly be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that frankly, even if that is the subtext of any Mayorkas confirmation battle, the text would likely be that, like, you know, he wasn't an outspoken immigration dove in the Obama administration. And frankly, it's been moderately surprising to me that the tone of the immigration advocacy community has been so positive toward him, because there was a marked difference in tone between what was being said about him when he was appointed and what was being said about Cecilia Munoz, who was the point person on immigration under the Obama administration, like was formally named to a position on the transition team, to a certain amount of blowback from advocates, you know, who didn't want just a return to the Obama status quo. But what Mayorkas was associated with during his time at USCIS was a scandal over the EB-5 investor visa program, which was, you know, a pretty like classic government scandal of a kind we didn't really see much of in the Obama administration, with like relatives of Terry McAuliffe needing favors and members of Congress getting inappropriately involved. And Mayorkas absolutely was a central figure in that. It didn't hurt, by the time kind of all of the details came out about it, he was already deputy secretary and it didn't like torch his career, but you could absolutely, that's the sort of thing you could absolutely see it coming up as a problem in a confirmation hearing, especially as Republicans have gotten a lot cooler on the idea of, you know, people who are rich enough to invest in American businesses should be able to immigrate more legally, more easily legally to the United States.
Well, also just if you're looking at pretext, right? It's like, you know, I'm looking at the dispute over some of the national security people's involvements with defense contractors, right? Like, we know that's not actually the reason a Republican senator would object to a Defense Department appointee. But if you want to object and you're looking for a reason, like, it's something you can say. And it's the same thing. Like, with Mayorkas, like, if you want to vote no on his confirmation, like, there's a scandal that's involved. There's also, like, so he wasn't known as an outspoken immigration dove, but, like, they did DAPA, right, by the end of the Obama administration when he was there. Republicans all opposed that. You know, it's thrown out in the courts. You can vote for him if you want to vote for him. Like, he's a competent, well-qualified person. But if you don't want to vote for him, it's, like, really easy to find a reason. And you can find reasons from the left. Like, you can find whatever kind of reasons you want. Immigration policy in the Obama administration was very messy. They changed directions a bunch of times. Basically, everybody was really mad at them at one time or another. And Biden does not have a... I don't think you could credibly claim that there's like a strong mandate for any particular course of action coming out of this election or anything Biden said during the campaign.
I do want to say a couple of things about a potential DHS confirmation battle that, you know, just that I think are make me think it's a little less likely. One is that it's not exactly as if you don't have a confirmed secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, you can't make policy. You know, I think that in general, I'm not expecting Mitch McConnell to say, well, I wasn't super mad about the proliferation of acting officials and failure to abide by some of the constraints of the Federal Vacancies Reform Act under Trump. So I won't have those concerns under Biden. But as far as DHS in particular, like, there is currently active litigation that the Trump administration keeps losing on whether a lot of the policies over the last year and change were implemented legally at all, because there are questions about whether Chad Wolf is legally serving as acting secretary. And so it would be very difficult for Senate Republicans to claim that acting secretary Mayorkas or whoever else would be in the acting secretary role wouldn't be able to make any policies, but would instead have to adhere to policies set by a previous unconfirmed acting secretary. So there is that. There's also, frankly, the fact that, and, you know, we discussed this closer to the election, it is looking very likely that you'll see certainly an increase over baseline in terms of the number of people trying to come into the U.S., you know, across the U.S.-Mexico border. It is entirely plausible, although not yet certain, that we will be seeing something closer to what we saw in 2014 and 2019, with the number of people coming in, especially like the number of children and families coming in, outstripping what physical capacity exists at the border to process them. This is especially going to be likely if we're still, if vaccines are not so widespread that we can expect that everyone coming into the U.S. doesn't have COVID-19. So that's going to be another political constraint on what the DHS secretary can do, and certainly another thing that is going to take up their time. But it's also something that is not, that is more likely to lead the Susan's Collins of the world to say, oh, we need experienced leadership at the helm because this is a crisis and we need somebody there who can steer it through.
So then, you know, the other thing, we don't have names for the constituent agencies here.
Agencies, no. And those are really, for all the reasons that we've been discussing, like, that kind of is ballgame. Like, when we talk about the duties on paper of any given administration job, what role they end up playing also depends on how close their relationship is with the White House and how much they can be expected plausibly to speak for the president. Like, because Joe Biden isn't known for really personally caring about immigration and wanting to follow up on immigration policies all the time, as, say, like, I mean, to the extent that Donald Trump was interested in any policy, it was certain aspects of his immigration policy. No top immigration appointee is going to have quite the, like, power to speak for the president that Trump's did. And so a lot of it really is going to devolve to, does the head of the relevant agency have the power and legitimacy within their workforce? And are they somebody who is willing to push hard in a certain direction, even if it's not being kind of ordered from the top that that's what they have to do?
And there is an interagency element, right? So there's the subordinate agencies, of which I guess ICE and Customs and Border Patrol, probably the most significant. USCIS, I think it's probably less contentious in a Biden framework.
Right. Although there are questions about how it's doing financially, given that it, you know, very nearly had to furlough 3/4 of its workforce last
right.
year.
But I mean, I think on the legal immigration pathway, I think people in Joe Biden's coalition are pretty broadly aligned, and there's not a lot of incredibly thorny questions there. But actually managing the Border Patrol and ICE is a difficult task in this. And then the Justice Department has a big say in immigration policy, right? So these immigration agencies used to be part of Justice before the Homeland Security reorganization. And because the Homeland Security reorganization happened as a response to 9/11, I would say the downstream consequences of this for making immigration policy were not thought through all that well. That when the enforcement agencies were part of DOJ, there was alignment between the prosecutors, the cops with the guns, the guys who write the memos in Maine Justice, and now it's split, right? So Stephen Miller's part of his portfolio, right, was like a kind of White House immigration czar type job.
Right. And one of Miller's key allies in the Trump administration, Jean Hamilton, shuffled between DHS and DOJ in the Trump administration, in part because the DOJ component of this was so important.
Right. So one question is going to be like, does somebody emerge in the Biden White House whose job is to manage this? Nobody who they've appointed so far necessarily seems like they would do that with an incredible amount of clout. Interagency coordination is one of these things where, like, you don't have to do it. Like, if you want the different agencies to be adrift and not aligned, like, that's fine. You know, and also, like, the White House can only focus on a certain number of things. Like, Trump happened to focus a lot on immigration. Obama, I mean, again, we've talked about the changes, of course, but it's like, certainly for his first 4 or 5 years in office, Obama was frying other fish primarily. And so a lot of stuff was going on that was not like at the epicenter of what the White House team was thinking about every day. Biden, it doesn't seem to me like he particularly wants an incredible amount of focus on immigration, but it may be right. Forced on him depending on how people react to Trump not being in office.
Right. I mean, it's not just a matter of, is there somebody at like the domestic policy council or whatever who has the immigration portfolio mm-hmm. such that somebody at the White House is monitoring the interagency work. There really is an extent to which, because so much of this is people who have a lot of policy tasks ahead of them, like, do you work super hard at DOJ on like going through all of the immigration precedents set under the Trump administration and reversing them? Like, that is a matter of manpower prioritization that you would need a clear signal from the White House to do if the AG is somebody who would rather be focusing on other things. And like having some random DPC staffer saying to you, hey, how is this going, is very different from having Stephen Miller right. saying, how is this going? So like, I do think that there's a certain that's the flip side of the increased awareness of the interagency stuff is just like, it's unreasonable to expect the Biden administration to be a photo negative of the Trump administration. And that, you know, that's certainly a constraint on how much they can undo, much less like affirmatively do in their own right. But it's totally possible that the efforts will instead be coming from within DHS, from within the component agencies. So it's possible that dynamic will just work differently. But, you know, it's also true that the people inside the White House have to deal with White House politics. And Cecilia Munoz, it wasn't that she was an affirmative immigration hawk. It was that during the first term of the Obama administration, it was just generally understood that she wasn't successfully getting the White House to think more about immigration and to be more sensitive to activists.
Well, her job was to tell the advocates to calm down. So the reason I think that like there is more furor against her than there was against Mayorkas is that he was not trotted out to scold them. They would have complaints about what DHS was doing and her job. And so I think it's unfair, frankly, the extent to which this like attaches to her personally. But it's like she was sent out by the White House to absorb their anger and then to tell them to shut up. And then eventually, right, it flips, right? Like when the Obama administration starts doing more what the activists wanted him to do, like she's very involved in that, right? And on selling Valerie Jarrett on the idea that this is going to be an important part of Obama's legacy and how he's remembered and all these other, I mean, you know, the nuances of intra-White House politics are interesting. But like the point is, again, this is probably not a job that somebody wants to do, right? Because it is very unlikely that whoever is the designated White House immigration person is going to deliver a series of smashing successes in which there's huge policy breakthroughs that make everybody happy. Like, I think this is going to be somebody who gets yelled at a lot by different people and is scapegoated for various things that are a little bit outside their control. And, you know, again, it's like you see this, the jobs people are clamoring for and there's the stuff that everyone's a little about. And like everything to do with immigration, as far as I can tell, is very much in the zone.
Right. I mean, also because anybody who had a role in the Obama administration is liable to come under fire from the left for similar reasons to the reasons Munoz has, for like, because they were associated with a policy that is now to the right of where the Democratic Party is. And anybody who doesn't have experience in government or in immigration policymaking at the federal level, like, there aren't just efficacy questions there. It's also not clear that that many of those people want to be in government. If you don't believe in federal immigration enforcement being something that deserves an entire, two entire agencies devoted to it, the prospect of going to work for the body that oversees those agencies isn't a terribly compelling one if you feel you can be doing work that better aligns with your values on the ground. And I think this is something that we just don't think of when we think of how to staff a Democratic administration, because generally you associate that kind of, you know, it's generally the case that would-be regulators are much more enthusiastic about going into government than they would be about like trying to sue companies through intermittently hostile courts. But I'm not going to say it's a pipeline problem, because that's not quite what's going on here, but it really isn't super clear how you fully staff up a department under a Democratic administration that isn't just taking back everybody who came in from the last administration. And the other kind of piece that's relevant here is how much desire is there to not appoint anybody who had a role in the Trump administration, because people who were civil servants, or, you know, especially senior civil servants who would want to get appointed by a Democratic administration into like policymaking roles, but who are associated with the Trump administration on immigration, you can see that being a much bigger liability for them than it generally is for people who are looking to transition into the political appointee tier of leadership.
I'm going to sermonize a little, though, here, right? Which is to say that I think you're right. It's, if you have a dovish view on immigration, it is going to, in fact, be much more comfortable to not be in the administration and to be able to just adhere to your sort of clear-minded views, you know, about no person is illegal and everything else like that. There's a robust infrastructure of immigration groups. There's a lot of good slogans and ideas. And the reality of policymaking is going to be really, really ugly, you know, and like, I can totally see it. But I really do think it is worth saying that just as on any other topic, it's like, it is true that the people who are in the government making decisions are really important. And even small differences at the margin in the way things are done have incredible significance to people's lives, you know? And I get, like, I've been emphasizing in all of my coverage of this, the extent to which, like, I totally get why people do not particularly want to do these jobs. But, like, getting in and doing them is still the biggest way that a person can contribute to what happens. Like, it's important to have good people doing things. That's, I don't know. Let's take a break. Let's talk about a white paper.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/nap. That's N-A-P-P.
Okay, so our white paper this week is from Bruce Sacerdote, Ranjan Segal, and Molly Cook. It is called Why is All COVID-19 News Bad News? This is a study that I have seen discussed widely, and it doesn't say what the people I've seen discussing it say that it says. So I have heard two takes on this study. One from the right is that this study shows that all of the COVID-19 coverage in the United States was very, very negative, and that that's unfair to Donald Trump. Another take I've seen from the left is that, of course, COVID-19 coverage was negative in tone. It's a virus that's killing lots of people. So what the study actually says is that the most highly read U.S. news sources, which is, you know, it's like Politico, the TV networks, the New York Times, the Washington Post, they have the list, that they were more negative than the less read U.S. publications, and also more negative than the foreign publications. So it's not like it's a bad news story. It's that this group of publications was unusually negative in its tone. They also show that you can look at the audience and you can see, like, conservatives like ABC News a lot better than the, like, New York Times. I don't know why. But there's no correlation between the sort of ideological nature of the publications. So that Fox, for example, was actually in the more negative half of the distribution. Not the most negative, but clearly the most conservative audience, but not the most positive kind of set. And then they show that this seems to be driven by audience demand, that other people who took a different approach did worse, that the negative tone stories, you know, were more popular than the positive
right.
ones.
Although at that point of their analysis, they are relying mostly on, like, the New York Times most read list. So it is of a more limited scope than their kind of broader across the political spectrum analysis.
Yes. But the New York Times analysis, I mean, it indicates something I've wondered about, because I read the New York Times every day. There's a lot of good stuff in there. But you also see some stuff gets buried and other stuff floats to the top of their stack. And on a lot of issues, they've had, like, an article at some point that's like, oh, people may not have much immunity even if they get sick and recover. And that'll be, like, incredibly popular. And then there'll be other articles that are like, no, it seems like this is, like, a normal virus and you have a lot of immunity. And, like, it's nowhere. And there've sort of been more optimistic and more pessimistic stories about vaccine timelines. It turns out the more optimistic takes, it looks like they were right. But the more pessimistic takes were more popular. And again, the Times ran as they should. Like, they ran stories on all sides of these. They were, like, the known unknown of the COVID-19 debate, but the audience was more into the pessimism and the skepticism than the hope and change aspect of it. And I mean, that is interesting in its own terms and is different from the kind of biased narrative or the, of course, it's negative narrative.
Right. And then, I mean, slightly more usefully, I think, than the kind of, oh, is this good? Are they, you know, is this because the media is trying to stick it to Donald Trump? Is the question of, like, has media coverage of the coronavirus pandemic actually been good for public health or not? And, like, the authors of the study kind of faint toward, at the beginning of the paper, the idea that, you know, the relentlessness of negative coverage is not good because it's going to exacerbate bad mental health outcomes, because it's possibly going to exacerbate kind of pandemic fatigue, in which people don't believe that anything they do is going to help, so they might as well, you know, act unsafely. But then, like, toward the end of the study, they end up noting that the widely consumed U.S. outlets that they're looking at were much more likely than comparable foreign outlets or than less read U.S. outlets to talk about the benefits of wearing masks and social distancing, like something like by, you know, more likely by a factor of 10 to talk about the benefits of wearing masks in any given article. And so it's not that the U.S. media wasn't promoting pro-social behaviors or was talking about this as some kind of fatalistic thing. It's just that those messages, A, there isn't a whole lot of discussion of how they were competing with messages from less formal news outlets, with, you know, particularly popular Facebook pages, that kind of thing. But also, the paper points out that the most covered kind of single event or kind of single through line in the coronavirus pandemic was Donald Trump's hyping of hydroxychloroquine. There we go. It's been a very long year and I used to know how to pronounce that and I've totally forgotten it. But that, you know, even though that was not as pro-social in terms of public health and adaptation as mask wearing and social distancing, that kind of blew up because A, the president has a massive platform, and B, it was kind of obviously novel and a little outrageous, whereas a lot of paragraphs about the importances of social distancing are going to get kind of tucked into the bottom of stories that are about something else.
But so I want to emphasize their finding about the hydroxychloroquine, because it's crazy in retrospect, although as somebody who was involved in the making of the sausage, like I was very much there too, which is that there was more coverage of the Trump hydroxychloroquine controversy than of all vaccine research.
Right.
And I read that. I was like, that's nuts. And then I like look back at what I wrote and like, yep, I wrote more about Trump and hydroxychloroquine than I did about vaccine research. And I don't know how much you can explain about the overall coverage picture just in terms of Trump, but it is true that Donald Trump for the past 5 or 6 years has been like this, it's like how they detect planets sometimes by the gravitational disturbances they cause, even when you can't see them directly. And there was just this incredible distortion field. Like, I have no idea why. And it's, to be clear, it's not unfair to Trump that we spend a lot of time talking about hydroxychloroquine. He chose to initiate a large national conversation about a fake cure when he could have spent time talking about learning about what Operation Warp Speed was doing in detail. He could have been pushing for human challenge trials to speed vaccine development.
All the things about the United States presidency that Donald Trump may not learn before he leaves office, the power of the bully pulpit is definitely not on that list. It's absolutely clear that he's been able to use it strategically to his advantage and that he could have redirected that energy if he so chose.
Right. But both he and us, like we just all on both sides of this controversy enjoyed like rushing in, like one of these like battles that breaks out in a war by accident, where he was getting criticized, so he would double down on this. So House Republicans were like touting hydroxychloroquine. It became a Fox thing in a positive domain. And like for some reason, an incredible amount of intellectual and journalistic energy wound up getting poured into this, I think with some real arms. I mean, I saw on Tyler Cohen's blog, some suggestive observational evidence about some other obscure drug that some doctors have been using, where the evidentiary base, you know, it's not gold standard randomized controlled trial stuff, but it looks much sounder than the hydroxy stuff ever did. But it's like nobody wants to touch it now because it became such a shit show the last time somebody was like, oh, I have promising treatment information.
And of course, there are the questions about whether vaccine uptake will be suppressed because of skepticism, both on the right of, you know, vaccines more broadly and of the seriousness of coronavirus, and skepticism on the left about the process, you know, about the legitimacy of any vaccine that the Trump administration is touting.
Yeah. And I mean, I think especially had Trump gotten reelected, I think that would have become a really acute problem. It's maybe with Biden, at least a more straightforward one. But I mean, it makes me wonder, like, can we as a society, like, recover from the Trump show and get back to some sense of, like, news judgment that makes sense? Because I remember in the early Trump years, this was always, I shouldn't say early Trump years, but, like, at the beginning of his campaign, this was always this question, was like, well, if we cover Trump, a lot of people click on the story. But also, it seems dumb to be giving all this coverage to Trump. But ultimately, the clicks ruled, right? And you can look at studies of coverage of the 2016 primary, and Trump just dominated. You know, it was completely impossible for any of the other candidates to get anybody to pay attention to them or what they were saying. And that continued to be the case through the general election, that a lot of the coverage of Trump was negative, was critical But it was like all about Trump. There was no stories about like Hillary Clinton's proposals to change corporate governance. You know, I think I wrote one and nobody read it. And then, you know, nobody says, okay, I just let the clicks drive what I do. No editor does that. I mean, we're better than that in this business, but we're not immune to the basic desire to like be in the mix, to write stories that people read. It's a bummer to work on something and nobody reads it. And if you write something that you know, you think is good and people read, that's great, even if it's maybe not the most important story in the world. But it's not like it doesn't seem good for society.
Yeah, I mean, something that you and I both learned, and I think a lot of our peers learned over the last 5 years, was how to wedge as much useful information as possible into a story about something that people wanted to read about, but we didn't think was particularly important. And that's not going to be the challenge moving forward. The challenge moving forward, frankly, is going to be how to even keep journalism alive to the point that like we can cover things. But also, there are big attention questions about what the level of appetite is and among whom for political and policy news in the coming years. And like, while this kind of gets easily caricatured into, you know, oh, you shouldn't be so complacent that you're just looking forward to going back to brunch or whatever, the question of what is a sustainable amount of engagement that is productive and will actually teach you something about the world and make you more likely to exercise your powers as a member of the community in ways that help your policy outcomes become more likely. Like, that is a hard question. And it is very obvious that the, you know, to borrow the John Mulaney, but the like horse in the hospital coverage of the Trump administration wasn't good for that, but that it also gave us an expectation for political news always being popping and always being surprising that isn't really reasonable. And I think no one knows what that's going to look like, because it's a matter of mental habits as much as anything. And those just haven't been developed yet.
Absolutely. No, it's hard to say, but it's sobering to look back at this study because COVID-19 pandemic is obviously not a Trump story per se. Like the fact that he's president is a significant aspect of American life, but like this would have been a big newsworthy occurrence anywhere. Even if you imagine some like much more successful, like New Zealand-esque set of policies occurring, you know, in New Zealand, well, they cut themselves off from the world for months and months and months, so they still need to know what's the deal with this virus, what's going on, and the extent to which, you know, in a seemingly bottom-up way, it's like everybody wanted to make this about Trump, right? So that we get like a lot of information about like, what is Trump saying? Are the things Trump is saying are true? Trump kind of setting the news agenda versus the relevance of information to your actual life setting the news agenda is, it troubles me, you know? I've just felt, I don't want to say that like I felt bad every day since Trump came down the escalators, but I have never felt satisfied with like what I have personally been able to do, or with what other institutions have been able to do, in terms of what's the right amount of volume to put on the Trump show. Because to just not cover the thing people want to read about and publish worthy stories that nobody reads is less, I think that can sound high-minded, but like ultimately that doesn't help anybody either. And so it's like, okay, can we like squeeze good stuff into Trump stories? Like what are we gonna do? And you know, the vaccine thing, it just reminds me that in general, it's like scientific research does not get covered a lot in America. Even though I think if you ask someone, like, is the progress of technology over time important to human destiny? They would say like, yes, no, obviously that's important. But it's like, do people click on it? Do they share it on Facebook? No.
Yeah, I mean, this is frankly a bigger conversation, and one that I'm hoping is happening like more explicitly than not, in a lot of contexts that aren't just journalists talking to journalists. But it's not like there aren't any efforts. Like Vox's Future Perfect, for example, is working on, you know, addressing some of the kind of similar cognitive problems to the problem of not focusing on scientific research. I think both, you know, some of the stuff you've been doing both at Vox and at Slow Boring, Matt has been thinking about, you know, telling people explicitly, like, what is the most helpful way that you can, that you as an individual can be engaging with the political process, not just treating it as like the show that you're watching and getting stressed about. And so, you know, I think that making sure that everyone is thinking about their own level of agency in this and what they want the end point to be in terms of how involved they want to be in politics, how much they want to, how much personal mental space they're willing to devote to it, and how they want to maximize their limited mental energy and resources, is like, there's no way we get to a good equilibrium on this if people are just letting the chips fall where they may and not having explicit conversations with themselves and others about how am I helping put forward the world I want to see.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you know, I mean, we try at the weeds to be at the fundamentals. I mean, I think that is definitely the mission of ProPublica. That's something I'm trying to do with my newsletter. It's what Future Perfect is all about. But it's like you, the customer, actually have a lot of influence over what happens in the media, both in the for-profit and the nonprofit sides, frankly, because even on a nonprofit basis, like, people don't want to fund things that nobody pays attention to. So like, it still matters how you allocate, you know, your shares and your clicks and things like that. So
right. And we certainly, I mean, I don't think I'm spilling any like secret sauce when I say that we at ProPublica have not figured out how to package a story so that people are guaranteed to read it in direct proportion to its importance. Like, there is no secret sauce on that.
Right. And, you know, and to be clear, right, it's like, even if like the exact fiscal cost benefit didn't line up, like, you could probably get donors for that, right? Like, if you could solve that problem of like the most important stories get the most readership, then the cost issues and other stuff like that would be easier to solve. So to an extent, it's like, it's on you, the customer, to make the media function. So obviously, you should hop in the Facebook group, but, you know, wherever you go in life, share the weeds and other quality stuff. So thanks, Dara. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. And the Weeds will be back on Friday.